Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration. Collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
My next interview is with Kevin Funk. He's a Canadian filmmaker, and we are talking today about his new film, Hello Destroyer, that's going to be at the Lightbox on March the 10th. You're going to have to get out and see this film. I'm not sure how long it's going to be there for, but Canadian Screen Award nominations for Best Motion Picture, Achievement in Direction, Original Screenplay, Performance by an Actor in a Leading Role, and it's a great film. It's a compelling film. It's nuanced and subtle and layered, and it's interesting. And it's about hockey, and it's about a Canadian institution, and I'll put institution in italics. I hope that's enough for you. Kevin and I talk about a little bit about everything. We talk about curious empathy and about ambiguity with an intention. And we talk about, you know, systemic violence and relationships and loneliness and a whole lot of really meaningful things really compelling, and sadly the conversation ended all too quickly, and I hope you feel the same way, and I'm looking forward to part two with Kevin. So stay tuned. Kevin Funk coming right up. DavidPeckLive.com for more information about my own podcasting, my writing, and my public speaking. You can also help me and support what I do here at Face to Face by donating through Patreon.com. And don't forget Rabble.ca for more information about other podcasting as well. Kevin Funk is coming right up as we talk about Hello Destroyer, his new film opening at March 10th, 2017 at TIFF, the Bell Lightbox, coming up soon. And, coming soon to a theater near you. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today who I actually missed at the Toronto Film Festival for a variety of reasons. I'm pretty sure he was just ignoring me. But we have a Canadian filmmaker here this morning with us to talk about his film, Hello Destroyer. Kevin Funk is with us here on an early Tuesday morning in Toronto. Kevin, thanks for your time today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me to chat about the film.
So are you still buzzing from TIFF, or have you come down from that at least?
Oh, I mean, at this point, TIFF feels like a couple of years ago.
I bet it does. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was wonderful. It was a strange experience, to be honest. Being there with a film, like a first film, a first feature film,
yes,
is very different. Like, I've been at TIFF four times with short films previous to this. And short filmmaking at a festival is pretty great because you just need to, like, make sure you show up sort of, you know, sober and coherent to your Q&As, and that's about, like, the only, I think, responsibility. So you get to see a lot more films, you get to just sort of, like, indulge in everything that a festival is. The experience with the film is, with a feature, there's just so many more obligations in terms of, like, just the business side of things,
right,
which is good,
and, right,
and
sure,
you know, it's nice that you're in demand and And I still love the festival world just because it still is the only venue where you get to do things like Q&As and you get to actually talk about the film. And which so is, that sort of stuff I love.
Which has got to be pretty exciting for a filmmaker like you. I mean, clearly, you don't have to go too deep into your bio on the website to get a sense for your commitment and passion to not only telling a great narrative story that you're drawn to, but to also peeling back a few layers.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been super interested in storytelling that's really rooted in strong sort of conceptual and thematic ideas, and that being something that really drives narrative for me. I'm someone just even in terms of the way I approach story, it's more operating from a thematic interest or some sort of like cultural critique or something like that. I mean, I've talked about this before, but when I sit down to write a script, generally, the character, like with this film, you know, it's a very intense sort of intimate character study. But when I start writing a film, generally everything I've written works this way. I don't know if I will forever, but right. For now, it's how I operate. So the character is very much sort of a means to an end in terms of like the tool that helps motivate or move forward the ideas that I'm really interested in. And I'm not someone who starts with like, oh, I think this is an interesting character. I want to explore what their lives are.
Right.
That gets filled in afterwards. And I don't want to like discount that element of it. I think a sense of like authenticity and, you know, capital T truth in their character is really important. But that's something that I fill in afterwards. I think, you know, in some ways, characters start as a device of exploration in terms of moving through these larger themes that I'm much more interested in generally.
So just before we go deep into some of the film, so are the two criteria for being a great Canadian filmmaker sobriety and coherence? Are those the two things?
I think that they're probably a baseline.
That's right.
They should be a baseline thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least if you're gonna try to answer questions about the film you've just made, you've got to at least be sober and coherent. I think that's going to be the main takeaway from today's interview. So
yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, I think that's more difficult than you'd think in the film festival world.
Yeah,
vices are around all the time.
No doubt. Listen, this film is about everything else other than hockey, it seems to me. I mean,
I think that is very true.
I mean, so I made a quick list this morning, just as I sort of prepped for our interview. Abandonment, relationships, violence, responsibility, choice, friendship, loneliness, authenticity, trauma, loss, grief, and just mental health. The mental health umbrella is huge.
Yeah.
And yet you've told it in a, I was going to say a uniquely Canadian way. I'm not sure it's all that unique in a Canadian sense. I think as a filmmaker it is, but I just, as I watched it, I just wondered, does hockey really make us that Canadian, you know? But anyway, I'm fascinated. And Kevin, congratulations on a beautiful and compelling and tragic film that needs to be seen.
But thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I just drew me in from the get-go. I played hockey as a kid. I saw a little bit of what's going on in the film, I suppose, from a narrative perspective. But I'll tell you what, I've definitely been touched by, you know, as you said earlier, you know, that overarching sense of concept, theme, and ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, for me, the hockey element is, I mean, you're spot on in terms of the way you're reading it and that sort of thing. For me, the hockey element is fairly superficial and
right.
It's certainly a red herring to a large degree. There's also a sort of cheekiness to it.
right.
I was going to use the F word, but I won't. But there is this sort of like F you to the,
right.
To the sort of idea of the stereotypical English Canadian film, and it's something I feel very strongly about. I've sort of spoken on this before, of just this sort of the way we've sort of pigeonholed English Canadian cinema into this specific idea of what we think it is, which is something that I think has hurt English Canadian cinema for a long time, and it's usually something that's dominated by either really boring outdated stereotypes or just an absolute lack of identity in terms of just like stripping away any elements that are Canadian so that we can sort of masquerade as being American. And I think that that is super problematic for a number of reasons, most notably in terms of just film being an important element of culture to help us understand and reflect our own identity and think about it. So there's this part that is a bit tongue-in-cheek about setting it in the hockey world. I mean, the thing is, the film depends on having a large, powerful cultural institution at its core.
Sure.
And so hockey serves that purpose very well. And there is, you know, there is a reality that, like, you know, I grew up, you know, not playing hockey at a high level, but, you know, I've watched so much hockey. I played road hockey pretty much every day.
Right. Yeah.
So there is something that's very ingrained in the, I played lots of other sports, a lot longer than I ever did hockey, but hockey still has this strange sort of, like, you know, just presence in like almost every element of our lives in this country, even if you're not interested at all. So, I mean, if I was making this film in the U.S., that institution would probably be the military that I would set this in.
Right, right.
And to be honest, the film and the structure and a lot of the issues probably have more to do with military culture than it does even hockey culture. But that being said, too, like I it was still very important to me to have the hockey element be very real and very true. And a lot of them are taken from my own experience with sports teams. I played more like rugby and basketball and that sort of thing. But I did want it to be true. And one thing that I have found fascinating in that, like, your sort of reading, which is like very much my intention, is generally what, you know, I think sort of the festival type, more like art house cinema viewer that takes from this film or finds in this film. But one of the things that was like, I have to say, a fair bit surprising even for me was seeing some of the reactions at screens we've had at TIFF or other places, where people did come to this film with no real knowledge of it other than the hockey element and the hockey parents and those type of things, and them having a very moving experience.
Yes.
And sometimes it was like uncomfortable or disquieting a bit, but not always. Like, I think that one of the fears our team had coming into this was they were worried that like this was going to be a film that the hockey community hated and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't ever really have that fear. I obviously knew there might be some negative pushback or press or whatever, but I think that would only come from people who didn't take a deep look at the film, because I don't think the film really, even in those hockey elements, is sort of commenting negatively on hockey, or say it doesn't even really pass judgment on whether violence or fighting in hockey is good or bad. I wouldn't be very interested in spending 2 years of my life making a movie just on whether fighting is good or bad in hockey. It's more about institutional violence and systemic issues of violence and the people who were sacrificed up from that. And that obviously is something that if your whole worldview is hockey and you're seeing this film that takes place in hockey, I think that you can really anchor into your own experience. Obviously, if you don't, and that isn't, I think that that's when you sort of step out of...
And Kevin, isn't the question too, where does... Okay, so it's not necessarily, like you say, it's not necessarily about the fighting in hockey or the militaristic edge. You know, what does he say at one point, the coach, this is how warriors do it, right? Mm-hmm. In the beginning of the film, what do you call it, the locker room. The question too, to me, it seems to is where does this come from? I mean, isn't that the bigger question? How do we pass this on within our families, within our cultures, within our communities, and to others? How does it happen on the playground? You know, bullying and so on. When you're talking about systemic violence, there's a whole lot of other issues at play.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. I think that, again, spot on in terms of like the interest that I have here. I mean, I'm someone who like firmly believes that, you know, 99.9% of violence is not something that is, or is something that is rooted in systemic and cultural conditions. You know, you have, again, I've mentioned this a couple times, but like, you know, you do have those situations where you have some psychopath who walks into a school and shoots up a bunch of like kids. I think, yes, that is outside of the conversation we're having. That's mental illness and deep, deep mental illness that I don't really know how much preventative things you can do. Those are like those strange apparitions that are really difficult to deal with. But I think most violence across the board comes from a place that, like I said, it has larger conditions attached to it. And again, one thing that I'm really interested in is the sense of cultural culpability that
right.
It's so easy for us to look at victim and, you know, and criminal in situations and really try to be as reductive as possible in terms of responsibility, because I think we love reductive justice because it's something that is very easy for us to comprehend and understand. And then we feel, you get the warm, fuzzy feeling of justice, right? Like a guilty verdict is, it feels like there's some sort of like empirical objective truth to that. And let's say, sure, maybe there is. Maybe this person did murder that person. But and that's not to, again, in all of this, I don't think you can discount individual moral responsibility and accountability. But I just think that if you are actually truly interested in solving problems around violence, most problems generally, you have to have that look into that gray zone that is really uncomfortable, because there aren't easy answers when we're talking about these broader conditions, because that's what makes it complicated and murky, and that's also what allows people to sort of obfuscate from their own responsibility, because you can sort of just pivot and sort of reposition a lot of these circumstances to be things that, you know, you're sort of imagining you're not really implicated in. And I think that is really problematic. I think I'm a huge believer in context, and I wish that we would, like, I have a strong political interest as well. And it's one of those things, I feel like if we could somehow really, really, and I was educated in this way strongly by a lot of great educators and also most predominantly by my parents, but I really think if there was a stronger emphasis on context and a curiosity around context, it would be so much easier to solve so many problems that we run into on a daily basis in the world.
Wow, so many questions, but and this connects to everything that I do. And curiosity around context, isn't that really about listening to others? Isn't that really about including and saying, what really is, I need to hear your story before I can say, A or B?
Totally. And I think that's something that I started to think so much more about. There's two notes on that. One more a personal one and one more related to the film, and I'll go the one with the film first, which is in terms of that idea of listening, like listening and the sense of communication or lack thereof is actually the true villain in the film. Like that is,
well, I want to go to the whole notion of silence as the violence. I mean, you use silence in so many ways in the film. You use it beautifully, you use it in a meditative way. It's relational, it's anti-relational. I mean, it's just the blocking, the cinematography, even for the love. It's brilliant. So yeah, we got to get to silence as violence, but go on context a little more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll hold that thought on the film for a second then, and go to my own personal journey, I guess, a little bit more, of being, there's something I've always thought about in terms of the work that I've wanted to make. I mean, my parents were activists from a young age. I grew up in my parents' theater company, which did environmental activism through theater. So I was in that environment a lot. I'm someone who I think has always had a certain degree of just curious empathy about me in terms of looking at the world around me. And it's like where I find the world most emotionally resonant and curious. As I start to practice my art, or start to sort of like hone my practice and what I wanted to do as a filmmaker, I was always coming back to films that are, you know, charged with some sort of like social critique, and this type of thing. But there's a sense, and this is definitely like an art school thing, but I think that, again, in terms of context, it's really important and really, really valuable to look at and question. Like, there is this sense that I'm speaking from a platform as, like, a white dude, you know? A white dude that's a part of, like, a colonial experience in this country that has very much shaped the position that I have and the privilege that I have. And I know, like, people can get so... this conversation can be so divisive as soon as you say that. Yeah, like, yes. I didn't grow up a rich white dude, you know?
Right.
But I still know, like, not by any stretch of the imagination, but I still know that, like, who I am has given me a certain amount of privilege. And I think that that doesn't mean that you need to back off of being engaged in issues that aren't necessarily identifying issues for you, because being a white man in Canada, you probably bear some responsibility for any of those issues historical context.
Yep.
But I do think that there is something about like how you engage and a sense of author. So like, for example, in this film, I'm sure like I'll step out further and further, but like to me, when we're talking about this sense of violence, and we're talking about something that's super, super interested in Canadian identity and is about that very specifically, to have that film not in some way comment upon the colonial experience and the history of this country would be really problematic to me. But I also knew that that wasn't the whole story of the film. So that's where, like, to me, it was something that I really took a lot of time to think about and try and, like, question, like, what was the most effective way to talk about this, but I also thought it was super essential. And so that's why there's things like, the branding of, like, the Warriors team, which is, which has, like, the tomahawk on it and the headdress that's used in the change room and these sort of elements, that, like, those sort of peripheral elements are really important as, like, this nod to talking about a history in this country and a violence of history in this country, which was like very deliberately chosen to be in the film, something that was like present but invisible at the same time.
I thought of A History of Violence, Cronenberg's film. I was taken to Sling Blade. Do you remember Sling Blade?
I haven't seen Sling Blade in a long time. Well, like I was young when I saw it.
Even American Beauty, the violence of American Beauty, of the silence of American Beauty. You look closer. You got to go a little deeper. And I mean, this is what I find so brilliant about the way you use silence in the film. I mean, right from in your face in the hotel room, the two, friends, small F probably, talking about a pretty central, important issue that comes full circle, at the end of the film, really, in truth. This guy's, life, his anxiety, he's laying it out. And his friend just doesn't have the resources to know how to connect, how to commiserate, how to empathize, how to root it contextually. Is that fair, Kevin? Is that getting too intellectual about what you're
trying? No. Not at all. This is exactly on track.
Yeah. I mean, I get so excited about it because the narrative story, but the undertones, I mean, this is kind of film that you can enjoy and watch and talk about, but I think people are going to be writing about this film. I think they're going to be writing about your filmmaking in years to come, Kevin, seriously. I mean, this is, you peeled back some pretty interesting, I think, and revealing existential cracks. I think you spent way too much time reading Heidegger at a younger age. That's what I think it has to do with.
I'm not even that well read on Heidegger. Those are the happy accidents.
You spent way too much time in Paris at those cafes smoking French cigarettes, man. That's what it was. Yeah.
No, I guess it comes obviously from personal interest for sure. But it also comes from an interest in telling stories that I think is a much more interesting way, in my mind, to engage with a story for a viewer. Like to give, I really do believe in this idea of handing a degree of agency back to the viewer. And I really do not have patience for the argument that audiences won't get things or won't understand things. It's like, if you're a teacher in a classroom and you don't sort of challenge your students to engage, I don't mean that in some like ridiculous condescending sort of arrangement that I'm the teacher and the audience is students. I'm just trying to use it as an example of the idea that like if you don't give people something to engage with, then they're going to be lazy about it. If you don't have a gym membership, you're probably not going to go to the gym and, work out. And so I think that like one core governing principle for me in terms of storytelling is that like, I think that curiosity and problem solving is just an innate human quality. I mean, that's why we are where we are today. Like, we want to understand things. And so I think that, you can also take that too far and I think be pretentious and make things so difficult that they frustrate people and they can't understand it, and that's where the frustration comes. So, like, I'm a firm believer in, like, this idea of ambiguity with intention, mm-hmm. where like mm-hmm. you have a lot, like you give a lot of space to the viewer to sort of engage with the film and the subject matter and the content, but there's always like direct intention behind it, you know? And I'm sure I would have filmmaker friends who sort of disagree with this and have very different ideas, but like, I just know from my own experience, like, I want to be challenged, but I also want to know that there's a means to an end, that I can access something,
right.
you know? And that doesn't mean that there has to be a concrete answer I arrive at that is like the filmmaker's answer. There just has to be room for answers to be arrived at. That's part of the satisfaction, I think.
What I love about what you've just said is that, and it's really clearly a core theme through the film and from your worldview, I suppose, is but just this notion of responsibility. The viewer has a responsibility as well that they bring to the theater or to the screen, to the story, and you're mm-hmm. saying, I'm going to trust them with that, right?
Yeah, it's something I really believe in.
So we cut to a scene near the beginning of the film. I think the coach is freaking out in the locker room. Disturbing, frankly. I've never been through that. I mean, I've seen a few angry coaches in my day, probably more angry parents in a sports setting. But I
will admit that scene, like, I was worried it was overly dramatic. And then I started doing like my research in terms of watching some, because I've had coach rants, not quite that level, but I even was even watching some like AHL and stuff, like mini series that they had. And it was like, as soon as I started watching that, I thought what I'd written in was like too weak. Like it wasn't,
wow.
extreme enough. So
do you remember that crazy drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket?
Oh yeah.
Well,
for sure.
That's what I went to.
Yeah.
That insanity.
That's definitely an influence.
The insanity, the humiliation of it.
Yeah.
And then you beautifully cut to that wide shot of it looks like everybody's got their heads bowed and they're all praying. Mm-hmm. it's beautiful, the juxtaposition there. I just love it. But anyway, so he says everyone has a role and everyone has a responsibility. And he's talking about the game, right? Like you abandoned your players out there. You know, what are you guys doing? Mm-hmm. You got to get in the corners. But and then basically proceeds to completely abandon his own responsibility. And if the film now becomes about culpability, moral culpability, and actually getting involved, and instead, what does everybody do right to the near the end of the film? And in the courtroom scene is so beautiful. It's just one person after another washing their hands of any mm-hmm. kind of relational connectivity or relational responsibility. It's quite disturbing.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I think like that really comes from, again, like the type of injustice that drives me the craziest is this sort of injustice.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think it's widespread? Is this happening? Is this happening in the back rooms of your local Walmart? Is this happening at Tim Hortons training that's going on, management training? Is this happening at the, you know? And I'm not pointing my finger at anybody in particular. I guess what I'm saying is just how systemic is this in Canadian society, or maybe even let's go global. Is this a human? Is this a problem of the human condition?
Yeah, like I wouldn't say it in a way that is. I wouldn't frame it in any way that seems like conspiratorial or anything. Like
right,
I think
right.
it's a human condition
yeah.
thing. Like I really
yeah.
think it's a human condition thing. It's a self-serving element of human condition. And there's a part of the voice of all those characters who abandon him that is rooted in reason that I can understand. Like
huh,
justification.
Huh.
Like I couldn't write any of those scenes if I thought that I was painting characters as just villains. You know, like
right,
when
right.
the when the stepdad, the billet dad, comes down and tells him he has to leave, and is sort of like graciously saying like, oh, you don't have to leave right away. You have to leave tomorrow.
Nice.
Like one of my, like, I find very funny.
Yeah.
Even though it's like a horrible scene. But like, I can justify Bill's position there, you know, like from his perspective. And again, this is like a context thing of like, if I'm in his position and his perspective, I can understand what he's doing. Do I think that that is then right? No, I don't think that that's right
yep,
for the situation. Yep. But again, this is where it loops back around to me to context. I think if because Jared's character, Jared is our lead actor, Tyson, But Tyson is doing that. Tyson is listening and sort of understanding. Maybe it's a bit more just acceptance, but I feel like he is sort of listening in that scene and understanding, whereas it's completely one way. Like, there is no, I mean, part of Tyson's struggle is that he's has no really ability to articulate himself other than through violence, and that's why there is this long pattern of violence throughout the film, where even if that's violence enacted on others or objects or himself, like, when he's asking for help, the only way he knows how to articulate himself is through violence. So, you know, he doesn't really have the tools, certainly in that scene, to really communicate, but that's part of the problem, is this one-way conversation. And yeah, I think if you look around the world, like, again, most, I think a lot of our deepest problems have to do with an inability to accept responsibility. And I would look at that even in my own personal life. You know, like, it's a hard thing to challenge yourself to admit when you're wrong, or admit, I think even more than when you're wrong, admit when you're a part of the problem. You know,
right.
I think that if we aren't solely the problem, or if there's ways to look at how other people maybe bear more responsibility, we defer to that often as our choice, because again, that puts us in a place where we have like this agency of judgment, which is this practical tool to create a space, like a sort of protective space around ourselves. And again, this is where I think that it becomes something that is really suffocating in terms of any meaningful consideration of responsibility, of looking at how we solve these type of problems. So yeah, like, I mean,
is it fear? Is it fear of vulnerability? Is it, I don't want to be found out. I don't want to be found out as a fraud, Kevin, so that you and I are together and I've got an opportunity to, I don't know, how could I even phrase this? But I shirk my responsibility towards you in some way at our first meeting where we have coffee, we meet on the street, whatever. Is that because I'm just afraid of you finding me out as some kind of fraud?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is probably like a great psychological question that like we should bring like a therapist in here too.
Hey, I know I could benefit from that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure
see,
I could.
See, the existentialist would say we're running from our freedom, right? The existentialist, De Beauvoir or Nietzsche or any of these guys, they would say we're running from our freedom. We don't want to really know who we actually are. So therefore, we avoid it through violence and sex and film and family and jobs, whatever it is, right? We don't actually want to put it on the table. And I think that's what's so beautifully brilliant about your film is it really isn't about what we're watching. it's about everything else.
Totally, right? Totally, yeah. And I think when you're talking about like the more personal level of accountability, I think that there are so many different shades, and I think that
sure.
is something that probably we all have our own fear, and I think that fear of responsibility is a real one. Like I think
I think you're right.
A dominating one. I think the one that I feel more concrete and sort of having an opinion on is the fear of responsibility in a cultural context. You know what I mean? Because it's like even people like, you know, I would have less problem with like jackass CEOs of financial institutions making millions and millions and millions of dollars off of like scamming people if that when they got busted, they also then had the gumption and guts to just serve like a real life sentence for what they did. You know what I mean? Like if you're going to be that, like, you know, that's just one example. But I mean, like, we are happy to take credit. I can say this even for myself, frankly.
Right.
I should probably use myself as an example. It's just like, it's very, we're always happy to take credit. You always want to take credit. Responsibility is a much harder thing to take. And I think that is something that, you know, and I don't even, it's not even that thing where I just think everyone's like a complete coward and we're all terrified. I honestly think a lot of it is just like this sort of natural movement that we do, you know, like this natural posturing of protecting ourselves. Like there's a real courage to responsibility, and I think that is a tough thing to reach.
And wouldn't you think, don't you think, Kevin, that I mean, okay, I absolutely shine the light in our own lives and our own families and communities and so on, but you don't have to look too far to see a lack of responsibility, say, for instance, in the political world, and you go, wow, so willing to take credit, but really, we don't need to talk about this right now, but doesn't good leadership, isn't it sort of synonymous with taking for responsibility? Sure. Hey guys, that was my fault. I'm really sorry about that. I blew it. Here's why, but let's stand up again and get back at it. You know, and I think people would resonate with that for the most part.
I firmly believe that is one of like the main failings in politics is just like this fear of responsibility is thinking that it's going to have negative impact. And maybe it has a negative impact for a certain degree, but I agree with you. I think that people appreciate that. And like, I mean, politics is an easy one to talk about just because we all know that game and it's so entrenched culturally. But like, to me, one that's way more interesting that, again, I sort of touched on earlier that I'm really interested in is cultural responsibility in this country for colonial history. Like,
well, now you're talking. Now you're talking about collective memory, and now you're talking about shared memory. And and this is where hockey is so interesting from a Canadian perspective, and also I would think intensely and deeply political as well. You know,
yeah, exactly.
So the connections are ridiculous, Kevin. I think you should be teaching it in a philosophy department somewhere in Stuttgart. That's what I think.
Well, we'll see. We'll see a few years down the line. I don't have the stamina for filmmaking anymore.
That's right. Hey, listen, sadly, we've got to wrap it up soon because I know you've got a couple of things you got to get to, I think.
Yes,
but
I do.
Can we just there seemed to be almost a throwaway line by the coach. And I want to know if it was a throwaway line or not. And
sure.
He said something about, you know, he's kind of reprimanding them for, and yet also trying to, you know, build them up, the team. And he says something about, or wherever you guys get your history from now these days.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that line. I mean, and it's a nice little segue from shared memory and responsibility culturally and as Canadians, you know, to the bigger picture with all that's going on right now with First Nations and communities and so on. How intentionally ambiguous was that?
Oh, it was fully intentional. there's pretty much nothing in the script that isn't written or isn't performed pretty much verbatim to the right, except for probably my favorite scene, which is in the trailer with Joe and Jared. Joe Buffalo is one of the actors who plays the character Eric, and he talks about his story with Wayne Gretzky and that type of thing.
Right.
Those stories are like from Joe's actual life, and I wrote them. They're changed a bit, like I wrote them, but I had Joe sort of tell them as his stories, which he does a great, amazing job of. But yeah, that other stuff, like those type of, I'm glad it feels throwaway. If it feels throwaway, then it feels natural.
Right. Totally.
And that's the whole intention. But yeah, like that, I mean, to be honest, the coach's stuff is some of the most difficult stuff to write because coach speak is so dramatic.
Yes. Yeah, it's true.
Heavy-handed, you know?
Yep. Yep.
And I really am terrified of that type of dialogue generally.
Right.
But that's the way that is spoken. So it's like finding a balance of what feels truthful and honest. But also maintaining the reality of that type of conversation and dialogue. So yeah, it was. I'm glad you had that as a question because that's a line I really love and is you're spot on. It's like very important in the context of the film and what this film's about.
Well, Kevin, I hope we can do part two. Honestly,
anytime, seriously,
like you know, there's so many things I want to go back to. I've highlighted in my notes, but capital T truth you mentioned right out of the gate. Holy mackerel, that's a whole interview in itself. Kevin Funk has been with us today. The film opens at TIFF Bell Lightbox on March 10th. And oh, hey, we didn't even talk about all the nominations: the Canadian Screen Awards, Best Motion Picture, Achievement in Direction, Original Screenplay, and Performance by an Actor in a Leading Role. Congratulations, man!
I know. I'm bad at the press stuff. I realize.
Yeah.
I didn't say the date once. March 10th.
Well, we're gonna pump it up for you as best we can. And thanks again for a great conversation and a beautiful film that I hope everybody sees.
Well, thank you so much for the conversation. It was wonderful. I loved it.